Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello there. That's my big bopper impersonation. And welcome to this big interview highlight show, where we're going to look back on the first season of the podcast during 2015-16 and pick out a theme to see what our guests had to say about it. This time, it's the city I call home. And I have been known to write a book about the football team. But I promise you that when the topic of Barca has arisen on the big interview, it's normally been at the urging of my guests. So today, we look back at what some of them had to say about this modern FC Barcelona team. One which, at various points in its evolution, has been properly called the greatest team in the world. It's a reasonable title for a book, that. You're going to hear from players who faced Barcelona pre-Guardiola. For example, Damien Duff was part of Jose Mourinho's first Chelsea team, playing against Frank Rijkaard's evolving Barca in the Champions League. What he has to say about it brings back memories of what has become probably the modern European vendetta. From Darren Fletcher, we hear about what it's like to not play against Barca, but instead to watch and to wish that you were in a Champions League final to boot. There's David Moyes, who beat Barca as manager of Real Sociedad, causing something of a Camp Nou crisis at the time. He'd tell us that the key to victory is not stopping Messi, but Iniesta. Gordon Strachan, now Scotland manager, then Celtic manager, will add further weight to the argument that that Spanish midfielder, not the Argentinian forward, is Barca's jewel in the crown. Gary Neville, on the other hand, rates Messi so highly that he's got an armoury of phrases, some of which he reserves only for this little footballing genius. Gary explains it better than I can. But first, back to the idea of playing Barca pre-Pep. Jody Morris, what a fantastic interview he gave us, was meant to be marking Guardiola, but ended up pitching himself against some kid called Xavi in the quarter-final of the 2000 Champions League. Xavi. Whatever happened to him? Take it away, Jody.
The epic that I remember that I wanted, that I've been desperate to bring up, is features Xavi, features Pep, because at that stage I'm reporting a lot on Chelsea and you. You've had one hell of a Champions League campaign. Luca really trusts you. You're playing a lot. You've played a huge amount of Champions League football in 99-2000.
Yeah.
And you've dealt with Milan, which I suppose player of your ilk, dealing with Milan, no big deal. Lazio, come and win at the Bridge, but you draw Barcelona.
Yeah.
And it's Louis van Gaal. It's funny how these names keep cropping up, but Louis van Gaal's Barcelona. And if I remember it correctly, I mean, it's a blitzkrieg game where Chelsea rip into a sort of fairly ragged Barcelona, who could really, really play and were full of stars, didn't dominate the ball, I don't think, as much as they do now. And if I am correct, you sacrifice almost all of the things that make you exceptional, use of the ball and time on the ball and what you might change the direction of a game, to swallow up Xavi Hernandez.
Yeah, it was kind of a weird one because it wasn't meant to be Xavi. We thought it was Guardiola, but he pulled out injured or something. But Luca felt that he was going to be fit. So anyway, when the team was announced, it was obviously I was playing. To be honest, I wasn't too surprised. As I said, I felt I deserved it the way I'd played in the league and stuff like that. But the fact that it's Barcelona, you do have to kind of pinch yourself on it. Their front three was Rivaldo, Kluivert and Figo. So yeah, outstanding. And I'd never heard of Xavi at the time. But he pulled me to one side and said, look, it's not going to be Guardiola, but the person that's playing instead of him is going to be just as good. It was like he went, I don't know whether he knew that at the time or whether he was just trying to keep me in, you need to prepare for this guy like he's Guardiola, so like to keep me in it. But I was like, yeah, I haven't heard. He went, no, he's a Spanish under 21 international, he's class, he does exactly the same things, and you need to play all the build up, the 2 days going into the game, you need to play exactly the same. And so obviously there's one part of me, because I always loved Guardiola, as I said, the Barcelona teams that I remember watching, I always remember Baquero, little midfielder, one touches and all that. But then Guardiola was a bit after it, and I'm like, oh, I would have loved to have played against Guardiola. But you're then thinking, right, who's this Xavi fella? Yeah. Little do you know, he could probably surpass Guardiola as a player. But yeah, I remember playing, I had to do a man-to-man marking job. It was literally wherever I am when we lose the ball, it was still fine on it, but wherever I am when we lose the ball, I need to just attach myself to Xavi. And he didn't play much that night, so I suppose that it was good on my point. It was a little bit weird for me. As I said, I wasn't used to playing. I've never, ever done a man-to-man marking role in my life, but I think Luca had trusted me as far as that I would do it. I would think of the team more than I would think about my own game.
I love that.
And yeah, as I said, it was on a night where the lads done great as a team, and to beat Barcelona 3-1 at home for a team that's first time in the Champions League, it was a special night.
OK, with care. You signed for Chelsea and along comes Mourinho and you turn up at the Camp Nou. I had just moved there and I needed my freelance revenue and put the team that I was covering most out of the Champions League, and it was quite dramatic and you were quite central. Can we talk about those two games?
Yeah.
So, the way I remember that game is Barcelona, still very fledgling, Rijkaard are completely outplayed and out-strategised as well. So, I don't know what the manager had said to you beforehand, but the way the game tilts, for those who didn't see it or maybe are younger, is that I think Carvalho puts a lovely ball down the right channel for you. You're away. You show Gio Van Bronckhorst not only clean heels but all your clean washing and centre it. And Belletti puts... It's your
goal. I was claiming that goal.
It's your goal. I was there. It's the first time I've ever nipped you anything quicker than you. But it was your goal. Of course it was. And Belletti says that too. You're 1-0 up. And then somebody puts quite a dangerous ball in from the wing.
It was me, yeah. For Drogba to send him off.
For Drogba to flat out assault Victor Valdes. Now, I'm only being provocative. And he gets sent off and it's a big old row. And Jose Mourinho says at the end of the game, Frank Rijkaard went into the referee's room or whatever. How did you guys, as a team, as a group, build up to that game? What was it like approaching the Camp Nou for the first time?
First time, yeah.
And the tactics and the strategy and the idea. And at 1-0 up, what was the feeling? You know, this is the boss. Tell me the whole. Bring me inside it. Epic.
To be fair, I can't remember.
And you know it's going to a very good part two for you. Eh? You know where it's going
to
end up.
To be fair, Mourinho wanted Barcelona. And we all thought, he's fucking crazy. Like, we were flying back from, I think, Moscow. They were in a group. Maybe we just topped their group. And the lads were just having a bit of crack with him. We're like, who do you want in the second round? And he goes, Barcelona. And we were like, are you for real? Like, and he goes, no, simple. We stopped them playing and they let us play. And it was as simple as that. I remember leading up to the game then. I think we lost in the FA Cup to Newcastle a couple of days beforehand.
1-0 maybe?
Yeah.
Up there? Yeah.
I had a knock. I remember him telling me I was playing, but I remember him playing a few mind games with the press. He named a totally different team and he goes, I'm going to do this later. He pulled me aside. You are playing tomorrow, but I'm going to give them... I think he said Gudjonsson was playing ahead of me. So when he did name the team on the TV, I started believing then. I thought, maybe his idea is playing. So then I thought, why are you... I'm not playing. So I kind of had to wait 24 hours for him to name the team, and yeah, lo and behold, I was in it. Yeah, for me, like every young child, you talk about teams in England, but to go and play in the Nou Camp... like dreams come true stuff. And that was probably the start of the rivalry that I guess still goes on to...
It's quite epic. It's been theatrical. It's been so...
And it probably all started that night with the sending off, Frisk, the dressing room stuff, which like we didn't even know what went on. We're just reading it in the...
I'm not trying to drag you into that. But if I look at it now, like, because you always hope, he genuinely hope, like, there's three journalists in this room, or communicators in this room, he genuinely hope that you call things accurately. And the first booking, I think, you know, it's one of those, maybe, or whatever. And one booking, it doesn't matter that much. Second booking, the ball, your point of view is more important than mine. But it looked to me as if the follow-through meant that in most times, you're going to get a yellow for that. I mean,
No.
You wouldn't be the first to tell me I'm wrong, so don't be slow.
Yeah, I remember. Was it two yellows or did he give him a straight
two
red?
Two yellows.
Well, listen, yeah, I'm obviously biased, but I remember back in the day, yeah, we were like, how can you send them off? And to be fair, like I call it the dark arts of the game. Maybe other players don't know it so well, but it was a Valdez in goal.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
And he's rolling around like he was being shot. Like, I think you have to do it nowadays. I've seen Mourinho. If a player didn't do that, he'd have a go at him then. That's the way the game is gone. It's just a small detail. Yeah,
be streetwise.
Yeah, he's probably caught him a little bit, but then Victor Valdez has been streetwise.
You look back at it, and it's still quite a flawed Barcelona team. They haven't reached maturity. They haven't fiddled around with certain parts that need to. Maxi Lopez changes the game, and that tells you something. Because Maxi was never really that much of a footballer.
Yeah.
And that was the end of it.
Yeah.
And so there's a bit of bad blood, and the first we hear of the Frisk thing is the media coming. Yeah. We go downstairs, and the press chief, I think, was Simon Greenberg, that said, he comes out, well, nobody from Chelsea will be talking. There's been an incident, and we're in the half, and off we go home. Oh, well, fair enough, that's okay then. And then comes, I don't know if it was a week later or 2 weeks, whatever. And so before we talk about goalkeepers again and Carvalho for the fourth goal, was that anger, those first sort of 30 minutes? Was it Barcelona's ineptitude? Was it better tactical planning by Mourinho? Because what was the adjective you'd reach for in that respect? A typhoon, a hurricane? You know, Barcelona were made for a chunk of time to look third division.
Yeah, what was it? 3 goals in 15, 20 minutes, I think. Just going back to what he said earlier. We stopped them playing, which we probably didn't stop Ronaldinho that night. It was an incredible performance. I remember that second goal, the toe bog. I've never seen it before.
Football, but it's not just that part.
The little shuffle before. It's incredible, yeah.
You'd never be sure.
They're always showing it in Sky Sports, and listen, you can't help but watch that game when it's on. But yeah, it was just, we believed. What can I say? Yeah, Barcelona, they were a world-class team then, but they still weren't the patch of what they are now.
No.
No chance of that. Yeah, it was just us believing. Mourinho was big on transition the minute you win the ball, and I think two or the three
transitions, please, because this is a word that gets used a lot.
Yeah, it's getting hammered
now in football. No, but I'm not saying it's happening. Some punters will know what it means visually, but won't know what it means as a phrase.
So, yeah, it was probably the first time I heard it was off him, and that was 10, 12 years ago. So, yeah, it's simple. It's if you lose the ball, it's transition from attack to defence.
Yeah.
So running back quickly, recovery runs or sprints. And on the other hand, if you win the ball like we did in that game against Barcelona.
Off Xavi.
Xavi.
Nicked off in the middle of the...
So it's transition from defence, you win the ball and exploding forwards, quick.
So it means also, it's not just your pace, it's mentally. Everybody's got to be like on their guard. That if the ball's won, everybody's doing something, right? Yeah.
So it's just having that switch, I guess. I said it's such a buzzword now I'm doing my coaching badges, like it gets absolutely slaughtered, and I kind of hate using it, but I guess it's the best phrase.
It means something.
Yeah.
It does practically mean something, which is you defend the phrase. Yeah. Then, and that's why I wanted you to explain it, because I think that one of the things that Sky, and I mean Sky, has helped us in Britain and Ireland to do as punters is to talk about football a little bit more intelligently. Yeah. There's a lot of very good ex-pro analysis. Yeah. Which reached a peak with Gary Neville and Jimmy Carragher, in my humble opinion.
Oh,
but it also means that some people around, you know, the football community, amateur football community, will use the words because they've heard it and they know it's appropriate, but they might not know what it means. And I think it's useful to know what a word means.
Yeah, well, that's when you do win the ball back. That's when teams are at their most vulnerable because they're not, I guess, in a defensive shape. Yeah. So the minute you win it, you're boom, you're gone. And like we steamrolled teams that year, you know, with just having that off to a tee, I guess. Like I could go through off the top of my head 30, 40 goals that I can remember, just win the ball back and go within 4 or 5 seconds. And yeah, he was probably the first. I said, I don't remember ever having that with any other coaches.
Did he give you dossiers on your opponents?
Yeah, every game you'd go in on, say, the Thursday, the game's on the Saturday, and there'd be a little dossier on your spot with, I don't know, 5, 6, 7, 8 pages, a little paragraph on each player, and then just pictures of the movements that they make on the pitch and what have you.
Just till I did that. Interest you, bore you? Did you kind of go, yeah, boss, I've read it, or you know what?
I'd never ask you, but yeah, I'd be a geek anyway, so yeah, I'd read it inside out. And to be fair, all the lads took it, and we take it away. And if you're in the hotel the night before, you'd have a little read. It's just small details, attention to detail. Like I mentioned to lads at Rovers, probably don't have Shamrock Rovers that is here.
Yeah,
and it's finance and time. They didn't really do it, but everywhere I've gone and coaches have took it on board, I've always said that that's what Mourinho did. They ended up doing it at Melbourne City. I was there last year, knowing your opponents.
If I've got it right in my mind right, you know, the Damien Duff goal is a 3-0 goal. And I think there's, you know, a big transition from, I think it's Carvalho to Cole.
Yeah, Cole.
What a pass, eh?
Yeah, wait, I don't
and
think I had to take
the
a
moment,
touch.
What Joe does, because Carvalho comes powering through, I think maybe nips off somebody's toes, and it's a volley pass from
that's incredible, I think it was up around his hip, and he's just stroked it, like, beautiful, beautiful ball. I don't think I took a touch, to be fair, it was just so perfectly weighted. And I remember, I probably didn't help proceedings on the night, running over, my mum and dad used to sit above the dugout. I was actually running over to them, but when you look back, it looks like I'm trying to dig Rijkaard out and the bench, where I think it kicked off a bit in the sideline.
Take
but I was
that,
actually,
Bob, take that.
Yeah, but I was actually just running over to my dad, you know. So,
or at least that's the worst story will remain.
No, yeah.
They were never there, were they?
He was there, all right. Yeah, he wouldn't miss that. He wouldn't miss that.
Is it just a waste of breath to talk? Was it planned that Ricky Carvalho would block off Valdez? And wait, who took that corner?
Me.
It's so kind of your tie, isn't it? Between the first goal and the sending off and the, you know, the 3-0 goal and then
bit,
the corner up there. It was a kind of...
Yeah, so I remember the four goals, horrendous corner. I near enough hit the penalty spot and it was, JT didn't get his head and it was going outside the box. I remember the minute I hit it, I was like, oh my God.
I don't understand that because, okay, maybe you didn't need to, but JT's completely, it's John Terry. Yeah. He's on his own.
Yeah.
And it's a massive leap. It's a beautiful header, however you describe the corner.
He made it a good ball. But again, Ricky Carvalho with the goalkeeper, it's just a dark art. It's just streetwise, giving him a little nudge.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I expect that aside from that passion to lift the cup and to play in that game and to fulfill a boyhood dream, the competitor in you and the analyst in you would have been looking at those two Barcelona sides. I'm leaving Moscow aside now because effectively you're a Champions League winner. I might ask in a minute how you feel about that, but the history books will always say, you know, Dan Fletcher was part of a Champions League winning squad. But analytically, I'm fairly sure you'd have liked to have done what Jose was talking about there and set yourself about stopping what Alex said, you know, they'll kill you with your passing. And from my humble point of view, even if he listens to this, I think particularly in 2011, he picked the wrong team. You weren't available in 2009, so he couldn't rescind the red card. But boy, they got a lot of space in the two games. Now, I've followed Alex Ferguson's career closer than he has. And to hear Alex Ferguson say after Rome, that goal after 9 minutes killed us. And that's the most atypical Alex Ferguson phrase ever. How can an Alex Ferguson team be beaten after 9 minutes at 1-0? But it was because that team wouldn't give the ball back. And I think both in 2009 and 11, when we spoke a lot before Wembley, and I was convinced that you were going to make it and that you would make a difference. I think, genuinely, maybe you think you're laughing at me now, maybe you think it's not your place to say it, but I think United would have been a damn sight closer to winning it had you been doing what you've just talked about, which was your art of making sure the good players can't play as well as they want to. That must be a separate frustration that you didn't get at. Test yourself against Xavi and Iniesta and Messi at their best and maybe beat them.
No, I think in 2009, I think it was a big part of our game plan and the way we, me not being there, as I spoke about, being the one to set a tempo and how we beat Arsenal in the semi-finals and how we you know, we were relentless in pressing and getting against them and setting a tempo in the match. And I personally think we were favourites in that final. I know a lot of people won't believe it, but and going in 2009, I felt like, I think maybe that, not that we didn't respect Barcelona, but there was no fear of Barcelona at that time. And mm-hmm. I think that might have ultimately helped us go in and win the match. They weren't regarded as the great team as they were. They were on the, they were going towards that. That was almost like the game that stamped it.
Totally right.
And we felt, I felt we would still win the game even without me. And I think the manager speaks about people not following the game plan to the letter. And we might get away with that in other games, but maybe you don't get away with it in Champions League final. And he still holds true that the players didn't fulfil what was expected of them or what was asked of them in the game. And maybe we did change the style and way we played because I wasn't in midfield. And I think we did a little bit because we didn't really go to relentlessly press them and stop them playing as maybe we should have or could have. I regret it because I feel like I could have made a difference. Yeah. I know people laugh at that.
No, I asked you the question and I'm saying it sincerely.
Yeah,
it's not praise because we're sitting across the table. I think if somebody can't see that, they don't watch football very well. Mm. Not just because of what you did or what Man United played like, but what Barcelona don't like. All right, neither of us can say you'd have won the game. You wouldn't have won the game. But if you even look at how the first goal comes and the amount of room that a 60% fit Andres Iniesta has to run with the ball before feeding it to Eto'o. Again, from my point of view. Now, it didn't mean no harm as a freelance journalist in Barcelona for them to win it. So I'm not actually saying I regret it, but it sticks out a mile.
Yeah, exactly. And we start the game so well. And, you know, in 2009, I was physically very, very, you know, like powerful and box to box, and stamina levels were very, very high. I was, you know, I'd started to get a bit of strength, and you know, not being the biggest physique in ever, and I could have done it for 90 minutes, pressed and closed down and harried and made it so difficult. And the team was built to play that day. That's how we got to the final. You know, Carlos Tevez, Wayne Rooney, you know, they could run and press all day. We had the capabilities of doing it, but we didn't follow our game plan, and we started the game very well and should go in the lead. But it's true in the both games. For 20 minutes, we managed to be able to sort of impact the game, but over 90, we just couldn't do it. And ultimately, especially in 2011, they completely dominated and controlled the game.
That's because
I don't think I was physically able to do it in 2011. I'd just come back from my illness, the first bout of it, and looking back, I was very fortunate to even make the bench. I think in your head you think, yeah, but looking back, I don't think I was physically at a point where I could have done what I'd have liked to have done in that final.
In life, you know, you've beaten the illness. It was a debilitating, depressing, horrible experience for you and your family. But you have beaten it. You're healthy, you're fit, you're young, you're talented. So rubbish though that experience was, you know, we move on and life is good. But if you look at 2011, if you look and say, my illness meant I couldn't have been the real Dan Fletcher on the pitch. So therefore, without saying you were a spectator, tell me a little bit about, because I think I've never heard an outpouring of praise for a football match, maybe with the exception of when I was growing up in 1970, for that game in particular. And Man United fans would text me or go on Twitter and say, we were well beaten. No soreness, like almost like it was good to watch them. What were the things about that side as you watched them? What was that experience of being close but not involved in that greatest team, club team ever, maybe, that night at Wembley? What do you think of them?
It was the ultimate performance as well as the ultimate. You know, so you can have great teams, but they put in the ultimate performance on the ultimate stage, the Champions League final, and they performed to the highest level I think they could. And I think for the great team to do that on such an occasion, I think it speaks volumes as well. You know, we get great performances that can happen in league matches, they can happen in group stages of the Champions League. But for them to execute in a Champions League final the way we did, we didn't lay a glove on that night. We scored a fantastic goal.
It's an unbelievably good goal, isn't it?
And I think I can't remember too many other chances apart from that. And it took us scoring a fantastic goal to get a goal. And it was almost like it's undefendable, the goal. I think if Arsenal even look at it, the move, 1-2, the way we scored, the finish, everything about it, that speaks volumes of the match, that it took us scoring an unbelievable passing, one touch move and an unbelievable finish to get one goal in the match when the rest of the time we didn't really lay a glove on them.
I think it's reminded me of the 2009 discussion we just had, because you score the goal because of the brilliant, I can't remember who presses, but I think it's a Barcelona throw-in, and United press down your right-hand side and press and win it, at pace, getting to the ball quickly, getting in, the ball's away, and then suddenly bish bash bosh, and Wayne does something beautiful. But I mean, to me, that still says 2009, 2011, had you been not suspended or fully fit in 2011, I can see in that little incident the difference it might have made. I was speaking to Abidal the other day, who came through a similar experience to you, in that, you know, he'd fought back from a tumour. He'd left a note to himself. I don't know if you know this. He played England at Wembley before he was diagnosed with his tumour in 2010, that season. And he said that they had a fad for doing that, the French team. They would leave themselves notes. If they were playing in the Stade de France and they were going to be back there for a major qualifier or there was a big cup final, they would leave a note to themselves, tuck it away, see if anybody found it, like kids, really. But Abidal left himself a little note in winter 2010 when France beat England 2-1. Benzema scored and he went, "I am coming back. This note is to you. I'll be here in May." And he went back and it had been tidied up. It had been cleaned. It had been taken away. But on that night, you wouldn't have been conscious of it at the time, but you must have been conscious later that Puyol and Xavi got together and said to lads, we're going to have Abidal the armband. He's going to lift the cup because he's just beaten cancer. Maybe that sounds obvious to do, but to me, I think it's not a lot of people in football would do that. You can't get Platini or Blatter out of the trophy shop because they want to be still holding it to the idiots that they are. But they were like, I tell you what, the greatest moment of our lives, let's give it to the French guy.
Yeah.
You've been in dressing rooms all your life. What does that make you feel like? What do you think of that gesture?
I think it speaks volume for the team that they had, the morale they had, what leaders they were. And, you know, to win the Champions League, to be captain, that's what you think about, to go and lift the trophy. And to give that up, everyone might say, that's because they've done it before or whatever. But to give that up to someone, I think it shows the power of football, and I experienced it with my illness, about how people contact that you would never believe and wish you luck and think about you and ask you how you're doing in certain situations. And I think it puts rivalry aside, it puts winning stuff aside, and it puts somebody who's ultimately could have lost their life and who's showed determination and courage to battle back, and then for his teammates to give him that honour to go and lift the Champions League for Barcelona, you know, I think it maybe speaks volumes of why they were such a great team as well, because they had that respect for each other, they had great leaders with compassion, and not only were they fantastic footballers, but to be a great team, it's your environment, it's your dressing room that drives you as well. You know, there's been so many great individuals, but they not only don't make a great team, and then having a great team means having a great dressing room. And all my time at Manchester United, we had a fantastic dressing room that they respected each other and drove each other forward. And I think you can see from Puyol and Xavi that they ran the dressing room, they ran the squad, they drove the squad to be the best. And then they also made the decisions that ultimately allowed Abidal to lift the trophy. I think that speaks volumes of them as people and also tells you why they were such a great team.
Maybe we could close by talking about what was a turning point in your year, I think, because you arrived here and the club was in a bit of a desperate situation. It was kind of grim weather-wise and you had a lot of work on your hands, and then suddenly you popped up one of those results against Football Club Barcelona, who did quite well this season. Won the treble, set records, made the world fall back in love with their brand of football. Rather than talking about the win itself, which hopefully this season you'll be able to experience again and against Madrid, tell me something about, as a football lover, being up close with Barcelona over the two games, what's it like? Is it an experience that you haven't had in any other competitions?
At Manchester United, we got to the quarter-final of the Champions League, and it was great. You know, we got to Bayern Munich, and it was probably Bayern Munich were a really good team and have been under Pep, very good. We had got to a level which actually last year no other English club got to. And the reason why I talk about the Champions League is because Barcelona have probably in the last 10 years near enough dominated. If it's not been them, it's Real Madrid. Mm-hmm. Now, Barcelona's style is, everybody knows, we talked about Johan Cruyff and probably the start of that period. Their style is completely different from MDL's. You know, even, I think Bayern have got a little bit closer to it, or a little bit towards it in a way with Pep. It's nearly a complete one-off, and actually, the majority of coaches, and far better coaches than me, have not been able to get results against them because you can't get the ball off them. You find it very difficult to put any pressure on them. When you do, they play around you. You play deep, they've still got the ability to score goals with individual talent they've got. So it becomes really, really hard as a coach to find a style, a way of beating Barcelona. So I've got to say, getting a result, coming up close against them, was a chance to see what is it they really do. And strange enough, in the first game, we scored after a minute and then sort of somehow hung on for the rest of it.
People forget that your goalkeeper, Geronimo, had one hell of a game.
Yeah, he did. I mean, but if you're going to play Barcelona, you're not going to have it any better.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Okay, and there'll always be a day when Barcelona lose games. Like any football team, they'll never always win football games. There'll be a day somewhere. But in the main, the best players, like Barcelona, top clubs, will win their games. For me, the big thing was getting close to Iniesta. Iniesta never gave the ball away, kept turning out of trouble. Anytime we got him in trouble, changed direction with the ball, kept getting the ball back. We could not get close to Iniesta. And, you know, for all the things they talk about Messi and Suarez and all the people, and on the night, you know, they didn't all start the game. It was Iniesta who was the one who I thought, my goodness, this guy's something else. It was like training. Nobody could get close enough to tackle him.
You've done something extraordinary. You've touched on an embarrassing subject for me, because when he was coming through, he was just a subject you and Billy were talking about earlier today in the canteen. He wasn't really trusted until he was about 22, which in retrospect seems demonically mad. You could see he was a good footballer when I moved over there, and it was a budding team under record, but he couldn't score. So my stupidity told me, there's a player who does everything and then doesn't have an end product, and I stopped seeing the things he was doing well. And Xavi, I revered, and Xavi still remains to me the greatest ever Spanish footballer. But the people in opposition to me, starting with you, Gordon Strachan, who almost word for word made the same points as you, and said, listen, people talk about Messi and Xavi, I want them to watch Iniesta. And also Xavi, if you say to Xavi, he's not even the best Spaniard at this club, it's Iniesta. You know, people who don't have your football training and your badges and your experience, what is it we miss about Iniesta? I mean, I'm aware he's top, but to put him in the pantheon you've just done.
It's nearly difficult to explain. This is a bit about explaining Barcelona. You know, look at all the coaches. I remember the great battles with Pep and Jose.
Yeah.
You know, probably about 5 years ago, where they were playing against each other and two great teams, and they ended up drawing each other, I think, just about in every competition and whatnot. Jose trying to find a way of beating the Barcelona style. So going back to Iniesta, if you press them, someone else will take his space. He'd keep the ball off you in a telephone box sort of thing. You know, he was so good, his close control, his technical ability, how to shield the ball away from you when you come into him. You know, he'd get his body between you and the ball. You know, he would unbalance you at times, you know, so that he could go past you. When you come in fast, he'd play past you one touch round the corner. Every time he got the ball, I mean, I don't know what his past success rate in the night was, but to me, I was thinking, he's never given the ball away, and he's... There's lots of players who don't give the ball away and keep it.
But what do they do with it?
But he was always looking to play forward, trying to play into people.
Do you class that as a form of bravery? I mean, in Jose's case, and I'll say this, you don't have to, but for Chelsea and Real Madrid, his idea was, I'll have a strategy, I'll ask my players to play to the top, but I'll also impose ourselves physically. We'll see if they fancy it.
Yeah.
See if I can con the referee. But I'm not talking about physical bravery and the idea that Iniesta might take a kick in for the taking on of risk. Wanting the ball all the time, doing things where if you're exposed and you have the ball ripped off you, your defence will be exposed and it'll be a goal. I consider that a form of bravery in Iniesta's play.
Definitely. And that's where Barcelona will take that risk. Teams down again get a little bit of joy. You might nick it off them now and again. But Barcelona do take that risk. I spoke to somebody in Spain when I came over, and they said, hey, don't get carried away. You know, what Pep done and what Barcelona done, as they called it, ticker-tacker. It's not always in Spain. And I've got to say, what I've seen since I've been in Spain is not that. I see one football club who are fantastic at it. But I wouldn't say that I see that all round the rest of Spain. I see good football, good technical players, all comfortable receiving the ball, being able to handle the ball in most situations. But Barcelona's a one-off. Will that change maybe in the time when maybe we've talked about Xavi, who's, you know, an extraordinary player like Iniesta is. Maybe when Xavi and Iniesta go, you know, when we're looking to maybe even Busquets goes, you know, and you're looking into the likes of Rakitic coming in, and maybe even when Messi's time, will Barcelona still be able to have the quality of the player to do what they're doing at the level they're doing? It'll be interesting to see in the next sort of period of Barcelona's football history, because people who, like you do, like I do, who We talk about football, we've seen a lot of eras, we've talked about a lot of good teams. Everybody's out there to find a way of stopping Barcelona at the moment. What way could we stop them? As you know, not many's found a way of it at the moment.
Rather than talking about the club and the team, Andres Iniesta, are there things about his football that draw your eye? Are you a particular appreciator of him? And when you watch him, what is it you see in Andres Iniesta?
What do you see? I see someone who's in love with the game. Someone who gets great enjoyment of playing alongside great players and watching great players and thinking they're great players. And he's oblivious to the fact that he's up there with them. I think there's a humility about him. Funny enough, most people I talk to always talk about Messi. I drag them to Iniesta. I first really came across him when Celtic played Barcelona many, many years ago. I think Barcelona had been known as a top side, but it was the first time I think they'd been kind of live on British football and British soil against Celtic. And I'm sure the midfield was Yaya Toure, Xavi and Iniesta. And we had Paul Hartley, Barry Robson, and he and other in there. I remember during the game, Barry Robson saying to me, "What do you do?" We can't get them. I just kept going, "We'll just run about, try and bat into one or two of them, annoy them." And after the game, the guy came in with the stats. And I've got to remember that when we played Man United, they had 340 passes. Benfica were something like 360. AC Milan, well, I don't know. Maybe run about the same. And he says, I said, "You got the stats?" He went, "Yeah, they had just over 700 passes." I went, "Your machine's broken." I went, "Have a look at that again." But what they've got, and Iniesta's got, and I was trying to talk to kids now, that we will be able to pass the ball to a certain extent, British clubs. But when people get close to us, we do not have the ability to beat people the way anybody in Barcelona does, especially in Iniesta, midfield and Xavi. If you watch British teams playing, we'll pass to a certain extent, then we'll have a hopeful ball somewhere or a flick. It doesn't happen that way at Barcelona, because they want to give you the best ball they can possibly give you to continue the move. And they're brave enough to be on the ball and beat somebody. I mean, anybody in the Barcelona side, they beat anybody at any given time in any space. We do not have that in Britain. People are looking for the answers, and just have a look at it. It's quite simple, really. Use your eyes, you'll see it. It'll stand out that they can beat anybody at any time. Also got the ability and decision making, and when to pass it, when to beat people. Well, I watched Barcelona play against Man City a couple of weeks ago, and I sat with my two boys at 36, 32, and Messi was just incredible. I said to them, "As you're watching this, remember where you were when you seen this." We're all sitting together because we're now watching Messi, magnificent, and Joe Hart putting the best goalkeeping display I've ever seen on at the same time. And when you watch Barcelona, sometimes in a strange way can get a bit tedious, because it all seems that, right, the same thing's happening all the time, there's nothing happening here. And then something happens every game that you've never seen.
Yeah.
Something will happen, like Iniesta taking the ball, he's in 18-yard box the other day there, turning somebody with his back to the opposite goal, beating three people, and the crowd building up. Now the hard part comes after he's beat three, because it's quite an instinctive thing that he's got a pass to make. I would say 9 times out of 10 people are getting misplaced that pass, because they've got excited, there's the final one, and that's the pass that counts to be a great player. And that's what he's come away with, a pass that Neymar doesn't even need to break his step. I actually think that we live in a great age with everything, technology, whatever you want to call it. There's so many things going on here that you couldn't imagine 40 years ago. I'm also seeing things that I couldn't imagine on the football field 40 years ago. I didn't think football could ever get as good as this when I see some players play.
Reaching for words under pressure, reaching for different grades of words, it's extraordinarily tough. If you're only coming out of a season calling back 4 or 5 phrases, 3 phrases, it's astronomically good.
It is about... Yeah, you're absolutely right. It is. It's where you're pitching it. Sometimes you can have a team that's absolutely fantastic, and you know, the amount of players I get heard called geniuses. He's magic. He's a genius.
Yeah.
He's a magician. No, he's not. There's nowhere to go from there. There's nowhere to go from genius. There's nowhere to go from magician. There's nowhere to go from. You know, these words leave you no room for. So I watch Messi play against Manchester City in the new camp. And I was genuinely, for the first time, I think, in my football career, I can think of maybe Ronaldo a couple of times at United where I was watching injured in 2007-08 where I was probably similarly mesmerised. But I was genuinely, as a broadcaster, the only time I've ever watched a performance where I've been genuinely mesmerised by a player was Messi for the 20 minutes before half-time in the Nou Camp against Manchester City. I was like, and I've seen him before, and I've seen him on the television, and you know, I've seen him live many times as you have. But I was genuinely thinking, this is as good as it's ever going to be. Yeah. This, I'm happy to use, I call it a scandalous, it's scandalous talent. It's out of this world, and people on social media will tell you, well, oh, you're bullying him up to it. But you cannot go, that's the point where I just thought, I have to go for it. But it's the only time. But once you've used that for him, everything else is below that. Everything else, every word, you know, you can't again go and call, you know, with respect, watching a player at Burnley Tottenham last week, you can't go and call him scandalous talent or a genius, because you've called Messi that. So I always like to think where I pitch things is relative generally through, and that's difficult. It's difficult to get that right, I think.
How much do you get in life that's completely free, reliable, regular, good for your sex life, and free? Yeah, the big interview. All of these, in their full form, and many more, are available if you search for the big interview on Acast, that's A-C-A-S-T, iTunes, or usually wherever you get your podcasts. The big interview was the idea of Backpage, and it's produced by them. Thanks to Beer Jacket for the music. Keep up to date with everything that we're doing at grahamhunter.tv, where there's a little box where you fill in your email address. And if you sign up there, you'll get our newsletter, which includes the opportunity to put your questions to our guests. We're on Facebook, search for The Big Interview, and GH Podcast on Twitter, plus Instagram. Keep in touch. Let us know what you think. More soon, baby.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.